And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025, and this is the final stream for tonight. And I'm now here with Gabriel and David from Tookie's Mag. Now, welcome, guys. Welcome to Millennial. Gabriel, first, could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Absolutely. I am Gabriel Kinboat Sinclair. I am one third of the Tookie's Mag Sidebar podcast. We review /dissident novels and literature. We try to really inculcate a sense of artistic vision to the scene. Because, you know, if you notice, we have, especially in the last 10 to 12 years, mostly 5 to 10, especially during post-COVID, there's a lot of people in our scene and this thing of ours publishing books and literature. But there's not many people actually reviewing the literature. So we thought we would actually try to fill in that particular niche and try to really inculcate a sense of literary criticism to our scene. And it was obviously, this is all Dave's plan, by the way. So he should probably go next now.
Yeah, the Amantha plan. Gabe, myself, and also our good friend Cap isn't here tonight. But yeah, we do the book cover. And I'm David. I do also have a Substack, Tookie's Mag on Substack. You can read stuff there. Have a book. I also do a little bit of writing. But we kind of started this about 2 years ago. You know, started as a Substack and then just kind of snowballed into doing the podcasting thing and everything. And we've just been having a good time. I think we kind of bring a fun spirit of, maybe give us some hard knocks as we read stuff.
Yeah, well, we'll get to the magazine and podcast later. I just want to know about your own backgrounds personally. Obviously, don't dox yourselves or whatever, but Gabriel, could you go first?
I am a Zoomer, bordering on Zillennial. I'm still holding on to my hairline as we speak. But I really just had an average growing up. You know, my family's from the Balkan country, former Yugoslavia. Grew up in the early 2000s. My first introduction to all of this. I mean, you were Dave's introduction to all of this. You know, I remember watching. This is so cliche for my generation in this thing of ours, but Mr. Medicare. And, you know, obviously Gamergate, you know, the 9/11 of my generation, I really got into this and really got kind of exposed to all of this. I remember very vividly, you know, seeing all this and kind of really being inculcated in all of this. And it's very bizarrely, I remember growing up, and I grew up very platonically, homeschooled for the most part. I remember everything when politics didn't exist. And it really just popped into my life. It really popped in. And I remember very vividly, my only social media I had was I used to go to this forum board for my favorite video game, Fallout. It was No Mutants Allowed. It was old school. I grew up on the forums. And I remember when politics was bringing up into the forum board, it was about video games and stuff like that. It was mostly just 90s stuff, music, and all these things. And politics started really bringing into 2015, 2016. And, you know, I met people there, and we got kicked out. You know, you saw the cultural kind of thing just start smashing into even, old niche internet forum boards, really. And that's how I really got into the scene in particular was, you know, Mr. Medicare and random, old head chuds on niche video game forum boards. And I was always a big reader and stuff like that. So I went hardcore and did old starter pack stuff. You know, I read Revolt Against the Modern World, Hans Hermann Hoppe, all the starter pack stuff, and now I'm here today, I guess.
Right. Okay. All right. And David, your own background?
Yeah, as Gabe teased, I'm here all because of you, Woes. I had a very normal life until then. I was actually pre-tuned out of politics stuff. I was young enough, or I'm old enough now, rather, that when I was young, I do remember 9/11 and living through all those changes. And I was certainly, I sort of drank the Kool-Aid and was sort of a group in conservative household, followed some of those sort of beliefs. And at a certain point, I was... living sort of the corporate lifestyle. And I've shared this before, you know, I was sort of living outside Arlington Cemetery, actually. You could hear the bugles play in the morning. And it was at that very shitty little red brick apartment where I at 11 at night or 10 o'clock or something, I stumbled across a man in a purple robe, the specific video I believe was Advice for the Fallen or the Lost, if you remember that one. And I wasn't really lost.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I had a pretty happy life, but I for some reason tuned in, and I had come across, I think, I guess some more Wignatty, however you want to put it, type people before, and I bounced off it completely, but I never heard someone speak in a language I felt like I understood about some of the things I had seen, but had never been able to compose into like a rational thought of why does this make me uncomfortable? Why do I think these are problems in the world until then? So I sort of binge watched until 1 a.m. or something, way too late because I'd work the next day. And then it started sort of a snowball effect to kind of get me here. And then during COVID, like many people, I started to go stir crazy. I started getting into writing more, reading more. Some things I sort of let fall by the wayside for other things. And that sort of led it to here.
Yeah, we basically started at very opposite ends, you know, while Dave was studying the Blade of the Woe. Like I was, eating my classical liberal meal at Applebee's with Don Sargon, classical liberals. And we eventually met in the middle, right around, when did we met, what, 2-3 years ago at this point?
Yeah, I think it's been 3 years now. Yeah, I remember because I was talking to the good guys at Unreal Press. Shout out Unreal Press. And then you showed up randomly and you started asking me about David Foster Wallace. Uninvited. You just showed up.
You could rock a bandana. But yeah, so it was right after COVID. COVID was an accelerant for both of our political landscapes. I'm not a tourist though. I'm pre-COVID, enlightened in all this.
Yeah, you're just young. And I just had followed it, but I didn't have any interest in participating until that point. And for me, it kind of also the way I like participating in this stuff, I don't get too into the horse race of like political campaigns and things like that. I think it's kind of funny how everyone and a lot of people in the scene talk about being post-political or not believing in the democratic process, but yet for some reason it's all people talk about. So I guess a lot of my excitement interest is more just what we can do to, I guess, communicate kind of the struggle or the weird paradoxes of just trying to exist in this world as we try to, as people that are aware of the issues and don't try to sugarcoat it.
Yeah. The video that you referred to was Advice for the Fallen, for the Broken. I think that was the one.
That's
that
it.
Right?
Absolutely.
Advice for the Broken. And in that one, I was addressing a younger guy. I think I was 33, 34 at that time. And I think the guy was about 25, 26. And so it's interesting because he was, as I recall, and this is a long time ago, this is 10 years ago. I can't believe it, but it is. And he was having some troubles, and I made this video to advise him. And that was what it was about. It was about dealing with depression. Would you say that young men at that time, and maybe now as well, are facing problems that their parents and grandparents just don't understand? Oh, Gabriel, you take that first.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I remember, I was very spurgy. I remember this. I was very spurgy with this because, my mother raised me in a very Socratic method, a very classical epitome of like the apolitical, we can discuss any topic, I'm an open book. And of course, I remember very vividly the It's Okay to Be White scandal. Remember all that people would plaster it in Australia and nearly banned, merely posted, putting a sticker, It's Okay to Be White. I remember that very vividly. I'm like, so mom, what's your thoughts on white genocide? And I remember her freaking the fuck out.
What'd she say?
She started screaming. I'm like, oh, you think you're Aryan? Aryan? Like, for some reason, in weird Soviet Game of Telephone, if you ask anyone, like my grandparents, like will criticize, a certain Israeli country, right? But then everyone, even the most chuddy, like Eastern European bloc, everyone thinks Hitler's half Jewish for some reason. Mm-hmm. So like my grandparents like, yeah, he was very much right in a lot of ways, but he was half Jewish. I'm like, where do you get this from? So it's very eclectic, very, very Balkan, Eastern European. Everyone has their esoteric Hitlerism going on. But so I've learned to like control my spurginess as I grew on. But absolutely, I do think, like, many ways, the younger, it's literally a language thing. You know, one of my famous quotes I like to recite is Wittgenstein's quote, you know, if a lion could talk, we couldn't understand him. Because a very embodied experience of a lion, you know, walking on fours, what does it mean to have fur? What does it mean to roll around in the dust, to sleep on a boiling rock? You know, the very act of being a lion totally disassociates you from its experience. So no matter how much theory I spew to a normie family member, even a well-meaning family member, they can't really fully, it's an embodied thing. They cannot, they can maybe grok it intellectually if you like slowly dog walk it and not go full spurgy over certain trigger words, but they can't really live it. When you're in that beautiful honeycomb of like apolitical early 2000s, 1990s normaldom, you know, just be normal, bro. The norminess of the 90s and 2000s. And, you know, we grew out of that cocoon. That cocoon has been rotting. I grew up in the rotting mold of that cocoon. So I can smell the rot and they can't. Their noses have been so purified by the sweet scent of its like springtime youth that they can't smell the rot. So I'd say absolutely that the young are experiencing something that's completely alien, that very, very few people who remember, who got high off that sweet smelling lotus, basically, cannot truly ever even approximate, much less actually understand.
Yeah.
Right. David.
Yeah, no, I think the boomer lotus sniffer is kind of an apt analogy, because you see these boomers speaking in very blunt, judgmental ways of the zoomers and the way they haven't succeeded in ways that seems normal and easy to them, right? Like, you know, I worked weekends and they got me all the way through college in my first house. I think it's a completely different economic. It breaks my heart. I just remember kids that were going through high school or college, university during COVID. And I think of that particular generation, and then you come out into this economy, which is an absolute nightmare in terms of, at least in America. I've heard things are not too good other places too, but in terms of employment due to AI, this entire AI situation. I've spoken to some actually boomers that are self-aware enough to say, basically, I'm grateful I got out when I did. Not even in a like, oh, you're on your own, kid, but just they recognize that the economy is shifting into a really weird direction where with technology, they're trying to squeeze out people from basic jobs and just automate everything, even in ways that the actual users don't want, right? Nobody is begging Microsoft to add AI crap to all their applications or PDF. You can't even open a PDF now with like three reminders to use AI to summarize a PDF for you. It terrifies me. Like I really worry about like the literacy of kids, and I have children myself, and I'm trying to shield them from a lot of this, but in some ways it's just kind of the world that they're growing up in. And I don't think we have to survive it, right? We have to find a way to endure it.
It is very confusing. I mean, I was old enough that, and I grew up in a, well, for the first 12 years of my life without the internet. And then it arrived around about then, 12, 13. And so I saw this change, but that was only the first phase of it. Then there was the social media phase, which was another change. And then the smartphone, and now AI. And so we've seen these very drastic changes happening. And I'm not surprised boomers, for example, are just checked out. I think they know enough to realize that this is beyond them. The world is going to be very different from the one that they've known. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, also, and they're less able to even understand AI, right? They're still struggling with social media, adapting to that. And now you have all these stories of these old people getting tricked by... CoffeeZilla just did a video about some poor paraplegic woman, boomer, and then some guy just sent these... Some guy in Uganda was just sending these really lazy AI edits of a celebrity falling in love with her and talking to her. But it was enough to trick her and then manipulate money out of her. I mean, that's kind of like a small example of a larger problem. They just don't have like the mental tools. They haven't put in the reps to kind of get there. What do you think, Gabe?
Yeah, they don't have a sort of immunity to it. Sorry, Gabriel.
No, you're all right. They don't have an immunity to it. Like, for my example, I just brought up, hey, you know, this, I remember very vividly, like, I forgot when that was. I guess the okay to be white thing was, what, 10 years ago now? 10 plus years ago now, maybe.
I think it was, 20, was that 2017, 2016?
Well, yeah, I think it was
after the election.
Yeah, well, it definitely was after the election. I remember that very vividly. And I remember, because as soon as you broke, especially you see the Pierce Morgan thing, as soon as you say anything about that, you know, like, oh, what about school shooters? Well, what about X, Y, and Z? They automatically program. They have like it's like a character sheet in RPG. You click, you say anything pro, like European or anything like that, and they have a full thing, you know, mid-century Germans, X, Y, and Z, and they just lore dump everything about all the, they regurgitate like instinctively at you. When you're just broaching the topic from first principles, like I was like, what are you talking about the concept of X, Y, and Z? And they're already dumping on you as if you're like been hardlining David Ehring for the last 10 years, you know?
Yeah, it's like a Pavlovian response. This is what they've known all their life.
Mm-hmm. You see that with the Pierce Morgan thing, right? As soon as, oh, are you a racist? That sounds racist. Are you racist? Oh, you're misogynistic. You sound like a misogynist. Like, it's like, it's literally a code word. It really is a code word. They think you press the misogynist button. It's literally, it's a Pavlovian, you hear X, you press the misogynist button. You hear Y, you press the Nazi button. And you slam that button instantly. It's an instant fight or flight reaction to them. They don't even like process in their brain before they smash that button, basically.
Yeah. And I think it's important to say, I'm not having a go at boomers specifically here, because I think, I mean, we're all going to be old. We're all going to be in our dotage one day, and we're all going to be befuddled by the modern world. It's going to happen to us all. But I think with the boomers, it's a specific thing where they've had a specific conditioning all of their lives. And it is absolutely to do with the mid-century Germans, as you say. And they just cannot get over it. It's like they default to that again and again and again. At a time when, well, you know, we are being replaced in our own homelands. So it's, to keep harking back to that just seems ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also they just grew up in a time of unparalleled economic opportunity and wealth expansion. And now I think by most measures, right, since 08, things have been either just barely holding together or declining in some ways. And there's no way to make everyone happy, right? It's like a game of musical chairs at this point, and people are starting to lose chairs. And as an older generation, I think you just rationalize it very naturally to say, you know, oh, I did the right things, that's why it's this way, it's, you know, younger people's fault. But I think people that are young enough to actually like grow up in this as like the normative state of loss of wealth, we're kind of reverting back to nature, right? We're becoming more aware. Oh yeah, there's only so many buffalo to catch on the prairie. They're valuable. There's only so many tech jobs in the U.S. They actually are valuable. They're not just going to keep making new ones, particularly with the whole AI thing. And sort of the tech overlords trying to use AI to sort of squeeze those last corners of wealth out before they're sucked dry too.
Yeah, I like what you say about a return to nature, because I think that is what's happening. I think what, in a way, what we're seeing is that from 1945 to about 2005, 2008, people were entranced by a set of ideas, equality, racial invisibility, racial blindness, feminism, and so on. And these detached them from what had been the norms throughout all of history. And now, as the economic prosperity wanes, these ideas become untenable and fall away. And so people, the younger people, are actually reverting to the ideas that got their ancestors through life, to some extent. Gabriel, would you take that?
Oh, no, absolutely. This would trigger Dave because it's my go-to reference. But Oswald Spengler speaks of this in Decline of the West. He notoriously uses the concept of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. We know a comparison as people. Dostoevsky as a religious figure was that of the Volk, either the folk or the Volk. Take your pick. And his religiousness and his was very substantiated in his lived experience as a Russian. And he compared that to Moscow versus St. Petersburg. The boomers grew up in St. Petersburg. And in Spengler's conception, Petersburg was a man-made thing. It's like a hot air balloon. People who, you know, it was very where the literati were, where people who are aristocratic and very liberal, cosmopolitan. Moscow is rooted into the Russian identity. Moscow is a stone where all the Volk of the Russian people are planted. And St. Petersburg was a city, is a hot air balloon that's vaguely tied to that stone and very wishes to be free from that stone to float away into the ether. And what we have become, what the boomers are slowly becoming, is what Spengler calls the fellaheen. And the fellaheen, in Spengler's terminology, basically represents people who are, history, discarded them and threw them away, basically. And I grew up as a fellaheen in many ways. You know, I mean, I don't want to say LARP, but I play act in certain ways, my identity. I mean, we all have to play act to a certain degree, our identities to a certain degree, our Europeanness, our rootedness, to a very large degree, because this wasn't handed down to us. You know, my parents especially, right, my upbringing especially was very neoliberal 1990s Americana, right? So this all comes as very LARPy to them. They wouldn't use that language, but LARPy. But from my perspective, you have to kind of play act the thing in order to mold yourself to the form that you're trying to play act as. You know, Bowden speaks of this in one of his famous speeches about like puppetry. You know, you have to step over that. You're on the stage of life and you have to kind of embody that sense of fire and recreation. You know, energy never dies. It's going to be shifted to another form. And, you know, what we're trying to do is our rooted identities. It can't be exactly as it was, but we can approximate a certain shape. We can mold it to something for the modern age. I think that's the only way thing we can do is to shape the energy of the past, of energy of who we are, and then shape into a new form, basically. Sorry if that was a little bit nebulous, but that's the closest thing I can really say right now.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I'm sorry, was it, do you have something you want to add on that?
No, go ahead.
One note on, it reminds me of something our buddy Thought Fox on Substack, he wrote a piece about sort of how you lose connection with practices if you don't live them daily, and via technology, which I think I blame for a large part of this cultural and this sort of economic restructuring, right, is a lot of it. I'm a little bit of a Greer head. I think a lot of it is from the switch to oil energy. There's a lot of like the form of oil, the utility of oil, and the way it is, it shapes your culture and the way you act and the way you think about the world. But the way Thought Fox was talking about it, I forget the exact author he was quoting. It was in his, he's actually making a book out of it. What is it? The Living Religion essay. And I talk about how from these, where New Lifestyle is, you lack the engagement with the supernatural as humans envision it, right? Like seeing a sunrise every day or seeing a great thunderstorm as you cower with your sheep behind some rocks. Like you lack those encounters with the divine or with the greater than yourself as you live in a more safe and nuclear or fossil fuel powered house, or need to rely on people like you were saying, Gabe. And so to me, like we're like four generations or so removed from that, at least from the Industrial Revolution. And so it was like, we kind of have to LARP to some extent. You have to LARP if you want to experience it in any form, or else you have to, I guess, try and ride the tiger and just embrace being a modern person as much as you can, while I guess maybe maintaining in your head some frame of what your true identity is. So yeah, I guess I endorse LARPing. That's the only thing I want to add.
Well, I think it's inevitable. I mean, people obviously are reaching back to something, and it doesn't come altogether naturally because it's not in the ether. It's not in the culture of today. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I think some degree of LARPing is just necessary in order to try to grasp what it is that we've lost.
Mm-hmm. But to admit it, right? You're like, yeah, so what? I'm LARPing, but I'm enjoying it. Whereas, you know, if you're not self-aware, then you become a parody. But I think if you know you're trying to embody something old, there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, you can't be self-consciously LARPing. I'd say that, you know, don't grow grim about the mouth, as Nietzsche would say. You have to approach it as if you're on top of a mountain, as a man from a great height. Mm-hmm. You know, people you know, come to our beliefs in many ways as an act of self-defense. Like how I initially viewed it was when you get introduced this idea of racialized concepts and so forth. You approach this from an idea of self-defense. Oh my God, I'm under attack, so I'll take this idea as a form of self-defense. I wouldn't do it if I didn't have to. And that's the big problem. That's a good initial step. But you got to be proactive and like, you know, hopefully in the future, you won't have to use this as self-defense. It'll just become a part of the way you live. And you can't be a very skittish like jackrabbit. I mean, it depends on the country you are, obviously. In certain islands, you may know a thing or two about this, Mr. Woes. But a certain degree, you have to envision like that's why, for example, Bowden was obsessed with comic books, because with comic books, you can visualize an internal archetype. The hero's never self-aware. The man, how many times have you seen a man in a gun in a poster or in a book or whatever? The hero, the archetypal hero, has totally submitted the idea of strength and glory, right? No matter how much you parried it or mock it or whatever, the archetype of the hero looking into the distance is internal. You have to tap into the stuff that is internal. Right, and you, and does it come, if even if it comes off as cringe or weird or strange, you have to just fully, what we would say is commit to the bit. That's what I would say, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think if someone is knowingly, deliberately playing a role, and sort of, then it becomes ironic and hollow and pointless. It's just a waste of time. So I completely agree with you. So let's get to Tookie's Mag as such, the podcast. David, would you like to introduce that to people?
Yeah, so we do a few things now. Buddy Cap runs LMD, which is more of a, I guess, like conspiracies and reading through books about different, yeah, conspiracy theories. And then, but really the, and then Gabe and I have another sideshow on sort of modern culture. But then probably the bread and butter that got us all together and started was we're actually on 4chan's lit board. So we were just some weirdos that hung out on 4chan's lit board. Then we connected after some kind of newer books were coming out, and something we thought were really good. And so we said, you know, no one is really covering these. And then actually a few that do squeak through, the reviews that often come out, you know, you may have seen these woes. At least for me, I see a lot of them as extraordinarily like ass kissy, not super exciting or interesting as a reader. It's a lot of my friend reviewing my book kind of energy, which I don't think does a favor to anybody. So like, let's just do a fun podcast where we do a nice deep read of a book, talk through it like a real book club, and then just say what we like, what we didn't like. You know, we're not final arbiters. We're not. I do not want to be some kind of like ultimate judge of anybody. To me, it's just a place for like frank feedback, and to me that creates a more living culture. That really is, Gabe threw that word in earlier, which I think is the perfect word for it. Like I mentioned the essay Living Religion. I actually wrote an essay on that as well, because I was very inspired by that concept at the time. I was like, let's get together and do a podcast on this, create a living culture by reading through the books and not just reading in isolation. Because so much, if you read a book by itself, you're not participating in the living culture of a literate society. It's, books are meant to be discussed. To me, that's one of the most exciting things, having read a book, is to get someone else's opinion or thoughts or observations, things that I missed from a text. So that's been a really fun and rewarding project to undertake, sort of reading through, particularly not just the big guys or some guy with a bazillion followers. We do quite a few kind of random people and, you know, people like us, like our size, little guys. It's really just, we're trying to find what's good and what's not, and be someone that readers can trust. You know, people kind of like us who maybe feel like they're going crazy in this world, like where they can find some books that are actually pretty good. And we've got some gems that we've uncovered for sure.
You know, shout out to Justin Moen, of course, our favorite author.
Yeah, Justin Moen, the famous father, patriarch beheader, who wrote a novella. He was in the news for a while, but yeah, it read like something a psychopath would read, or a schizophrenic rather. But yeah, no, you know, I don't want to go through every single one, but there's quite a few really good ones on there. One of them, surprisingly, actually, the My Confession by Samuel Chamberlain, maybe my favorite. He's actually a period piece from the Mexican-American War. Not a war I'm particularly interested in, but extraordinarily well written, very a very spicy take, I would say, on the war.
Yeah. A favorite of mine is, of course, a most recent Fed book. Shout out to John Stancliffe, who's very much on our side, very much so, and also was a founding member of the Lit Board in many ways. To tie back to our idea of LARPing a certain degree, to use another Spenglerian term, that Reformation is not a renewal; it's an end of something. Every time you try to play act at a Reformation, there's this wonderful line from Volume 2 of Spengler, where he discusses Martin Luther saw everything as a city man, not as a Volk. There's a frenzied loneliness in any act of Reformation, right? He saw everything through his little village, through a little window, right? And intrinsically via cosmopolitan, almost a pseudo class conflict. And comparing it to Oliver Cromwell, right? The Puritans, there was a sense of frenzied loneliness. Heaven is far away, but the demons are close, that kind of thing. And so in any act of Reformation or attempt at a proper capital R Reformation, because things start off organically. Again, it's difference between a natural expression versus a rehearsed expression of the body. And what we try to do is that we try to review stuff that doesn't come up as like capital R reformed literature, trying to call back to like a frozen trad stuff. We don't want to read too busy being didactic. You're familiar with the term Zog Chow. We call it Chud Chow. Like stuff that you only read it just because you're a chud. You know what I mean? We want something that actually feels confident in itself, that speaks from a moment of today, through our lens, through our politics, through our beliefs, right? But it comes out as confident and from a great height, to put it in a chain sense, from a great height with confidence that actually expresses the reader's view of the world with class, with style, something that would actually, if 10 years, 100 years from now, if we win, like in base world, we don't want to read it, this is how bad things were. Like, no, this is a forerunner of our movement. Something that's like irony coded and chuddy and funny, like, or so like esoteric and extreme, like surf edits on Twitter, right? And we don't want to do anything that's only like what you said, irony poison. We want to look at something like, this isn't funny, this is accurate, this is a natural expression of this person's personality that happens to be organically chuddy. Well, again, it's different between proactive and versus the whole self-defense concept I talked about earlier. We especially want something that is proactively, I am that I am kind of thing.
And countering social media mediation, because when you have the popularity of books purely based on Twitter clout or someone being enough of a psychopath to thrive on Twitter by just posting videos of white women being punched by Afghan people like 12 times a day to get people around the world's adrenaline pumping and angry, if that's what's like generating the book attention, to me that's morally worth opposing and trying to encourage more thoughtful readership, more thoughtful discussion of reading. And so I'm hoping that we can sort of be a point of that, and then other people coming on and doing it, which fortunately there already is. Shout out to Subverted Subversions, friends Kingbridge and Jesse Larkins to do something there. So some similar stuff, but yeah, I think we just need a lot more of that to create like an actual more meaningful staying culture with staying power.
All right. So what gap, because you started talking about this before we went on air, so I'll ask you now, what gap do you think that Tookie's Mac fills, Gabriel?
We actually discussed, we have a deluge of, people who either got red-pilled from COVID or beforehand. A lot of city hipsters got into, like, the e-write scene right around COVID, and of course they write books. And what the best of these, sorry to shout out once more, but shout out to Dan Baltic. He helped us a lot growing our channel. He was the first big guy.
Big homie.
Yeah, him and Prudentialist. And the reason why we want to fill this gap is a commentariat. You read something like Marcel Proust, you read In Search of Lost Time, and you see this organic, it comes off as somewhat longhousey and very Keeping Up the Joneses. But the point is the cultural expression. When Charles Swan in that book remembers the Moonlight Sonata, right, for the beauty, and he embodies this extremely embodied experience of the Moonlight Sonata when he hears the Moonlight Sonata for the first time, the way Marcel Proust describes it, it is an extremely organism experience. I don't want to use orgasmic in the wrong context, but it is orgasmic in a sense when you read that particular part of In Search of Lost Time. And what we do is like, yes, this book is, books we review for the most part are chud by default. Is it based? Yes. Next question is it good? And the quality of the work supersedes the chuddiness of the book. Because we were today as a given. We wanted the best, the strongest, the boldest. So what we come in, if a book is shit, we'll call it shit. If a book is great, we'll sing it to high heavens. And what we're really doing is almost like a literary eugenics program, you know, in many sense. It really is. We're really trying to snip off the bad branches and to build the strongest literature we can. That's the whole point of commentary. It'd be funny. One of my favorite commentariats back in the day was Harold Bloom. And, you know, we don't live past 100 years. You know, we have very short time to read a book. And we only have time to read the best. And, you know, we can't just have slop, AI-generated slop, you know, ChatGPT, the N-word 100 times, even though it'd be a base GigaChat edit. But in reality, we want something that is confident in itself and actually expresses something that will make you intuitively understand and feel something the way Marcel Proust did in Search of Lost Time. And the reason why you see this upgrowth of magazines like Passage or, again, Tookie's Mag, what we're trying to do, is that it's not only about having your book out there and maybe selling 10 copies on Amazon. It's having a book out there and having an effect on your volk, on your people, on your tribe. And this is an expression of our art. The way Spengler would say, Richard Wagner or Richard Wagner was an expression of the Faustian spirit. This piece of work, this X book, Fed book, or Sleep Capricorn is an expression of what our people's spirit is today, and is the best embodiment of that particular spirit. So when I say we are trying to fill in a niche, we're trying to actually be people on a hill and try to, like, in a platonic sense, train the new generation of the men of gold to try to inculcate an actually true a literary aristocracy in the truest sense of the term.
I think it might be a pinch dramatic, Gabe. I agree we're trying to encourage people to do write good stuff, but I don't view us as like judges or like the final say at all. To me, it's just like a real, like a sounding board.
I very well do view myself as the final say, by the way. Yeah. All the books I say are bad are objectively bad. Mm-hmm.
You thumbs up some real stinkers, so I guess people can watch for themselves, but... Yeah, no, I generally agree with what you're saying, though, Gabe. I guess kind of the niche we fill, at least with that, you know. Then we have our other series that kind of do things that I think other people have done in other ways, but I think just sort of our view on it, you know. We do the Slop Kings, where we just obsess about Brandon Sanderson.
And Todd Howard, yeah.
Yeah, great saviors. And just sort of what makes those guys successful, and like what does success mean in this sort of, you know, we're at the era where the institution, you know, the book publisher has fallen and the platform, the social media presence, the Twitter presence has risen. And we're pretty well post that, right? A lot of these institutions are just sort of straggling, feeble old creatures hanging on, trying to buy up and glom up these social media presences on the platform control on whatever these ever shrinking number of platforms that matter are. I can
give you some anecdotal experience here, because in 2012 I was looking into getting a novel published. I'd written a novel, and I approached literary agents, and what I discovered was that all of them, and this was 2012, so it's only 13 years ago, they all wanted manuscripts printed and bound and posted to them, mailed. None of them accepted an emailed PDF, which was infinitely easier and cheaper to send. But they were all still stuck in this 20th century mentality. And at the time, they still controlled the publishing. Well, I'm sure they still do control the publishing industry, the access to it. And so it was bad news for me. But 13 years on, I think, well, they're probably now dinosaurs. You know, that's one reason why the publishing industry is just obsolete now, because it refused to adapt to the modern era.
Brandon Sanderson actually speaks of this, and not to call, yeah. We do have fun as well. I mean, I may have 3+ hours of me doing a Spenglerian analysis of the entire Elder Scrolls series underneath my belt, and so, you know, me and Dave are effectively obsessed with old school CRPG video games. And so for me, that's my background anyway. Before Big Woke took that away from me and took it from all white men and our authentic culture being video games. All right, we do have a lot of fun analyzing fiction and literature and stuff like that, particularly video games, basically. Again, our patron saints are Brandon Sanderson and Todd Howard in many profound ways. And what you're speaking of earlier about that, Brandon Sanderson actually discussed this as well with the modern day literary thing, is that fundamentally you cannot get into the old ways. You cannot go to a literary convention, because that's how people did it back in the old days, and particularly in the fantasy unit back in America, at least. You know, you go to a fantasy con, you shake hands with authors, and not like in a sleazy way, but you actually would hang out with people.
You got drinks after the talk, and you just hung out for hours.
And you'll shake hands and talk to the head of Tor. Tor is one of the biggest fantasy companies out there. And the head of the company, of the publishing house, would read your book and himself and judge whether or not to publish it. It's completely alien to the current way that things are done. And yes, is PDF easier? Yes, it is. Digital is easier. But when there's no friction, when something's completely like sliding off the surface like that, there is a sense of it being less, again, organic. Right, you don't have to physically hand in your papers anymore. Now it's all based on a totally digitalized circumstance.
When they hand over the messy middle, right? There's not people reviewing. Either you go the self pub, and there's no like middle control editing unless you pay a lot for it. You're probably not gonna make that money back. Or you go through the publisher, and like you said, Gabe, good luck at this point. Was if you tried to do that now too, just so you know, they would probably also email you and say, oh, by the way, what's your promotion plan? It's like, wait, isn't that your job? Isn't that why I have it published with you? But now they say, no, what's your promotion plan? Text me or message, email me your followers on XYZ accounts. How are you going to promote this over 6 months to sell this book? Just as a sense of how outdated a lot of these big publishers are. They're never going to shut down, of course. You know, these guys, they still make millions of dollars a year selling the Scarlet Letter. They still all these old books that they publish, Penguin House or whatever, that's where their money comes from. And then the modern publishing wings, I'm sure people are well aware of by now, is just sort of friends of theirs.
Yeah, I think in many ways, literature is returning to its old days, rather than being an inflated world balloon of like, infinite jest sold like 500,000 copies in the first week. You know, that thick book was a bestseller. You know, instead of for the masses, books will be back into cliques, into book clubs. You know, this is like J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis talking about, you know, what their friends read that day or something like that. It'll be back to book clubs and social gatherings and cafes and basically cafes and parlors at this point. I mean, literature and reading was always a very small group. And, you know, Arthur Schopenhauer said it best, the fewer people who read, the better the literature it is. Far too many people know how to read. It's not the opposite way. It's not enough people know how to read. It's too many people know how to read in many ways. People don't know how to read properly. So I think eventually, just through sheer basically evolutionary pressure, literature will come back to being that of particular cliques. You know, if on an e-write, most successful e-write author will not sell 10,000 copies in the first week, much less 100,000. But the best they can do is that a book will be reviewed, and it will be reviewed either by their personal friend group or will form a clique and become not cult classic implies a certain idea of it being particularly hidden, but a private society. There's something cult has too much of a negative connotation, but a privately selected clusters of tribes basically become a tribal folk art again. Literature will revert back to it being of a particular class, of a particular space, of a particular nomos, and rather than it being of the just an ethereal of the masses, I'd say.
The problem is that someone can produce something like a book, but then if it doesn't get taken up by the mainstream industry, which involves critics reviewing it, newspapers, advertising, etc., then it might be a great book, but it doesn't become part of the culture. It just, if you self-publish, for example, you self-publish it into nowhere, into nothing. And I think that we need, as much as we need the people writing the books, we need a system to deal with them after that fact, after it's been produced, to publicize it and promote it in various ways. Otherwise, it won't become part of any culture. And so I think this is what something like Tookie's Mag is doing and should do. And I think we need things like that, because otherwise it's just people operating on their own into a vacuum.
Well, it's the return of the academy or the gymnasium in the Greek sense. You know, Plato didn't just write the Republic and buggered off into his little goon cave, or his Platonic version of a goon cave. He advised dictators. He tried to have an active participation in not only of his writing, but actually participate in trying to inculcate his writing into his particular society. And I think that it's a return to not the academy as what, how we would say, well, our conception of the academy in the Greek sense of the term, of schools, of Aristotle and Plato walking around with their students and literally like memorizing verbatim word by word, the poetry of Homer, right? I think that's basically the best we can, in a digitalized format, in a decentralized way, is like literally little pockets of schools, if you will. Again, you can't just write into the ether. You know, it's not even, it's worse than Plato's cave. The better, a modern day example of Plato's cave is, instead of the cave portraying shadows, it's portraying glass. It's a cave of crystals, basically reflecting back at you. You get endlessly entertain yourself or writing into the ether, basically, and just completely live in your own reality of your own literature. You know, especially, you know, me and Dave are very fantasy sci-fi heads. You see all these people on Lit. They can world build and give their histories, a 1,000-year lore and history of their peoples and the elves and the dwarves, and they endlessly entertain themselves doing that way. It becomes, literature becomes masturbatory in that sense. You're writing for yourself, purely of a purely sense of self, rather than writing it for you are a readership. There's no sense of readership. That's merely masturbation, rather than actual reading as entertainment versus reading as entertainment versus literature as a group activity. Something that's supposed to be spoken. Again, it's words. Words are primarily supposed to be received as signs and symbols. Symbols are supposed to be symbols to other people. That's the whole point of a language. And so what we try to do is basically what you said earlier is that instead of shouting into the ether, we're fishermen. We fish, we see what fish are out there. We try to hook them and we try to examine them and actually and show it, basically come back to the tribe, see what will be caught, see if this is a good fish. If it's a bad fish, we throw it back into the water.
Yeah, I try to be too elitist in my judgments of people's reading. Are you familiar with Lit RPG?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. It's enormously popular. So you mentioned throwing your stuff up online and no one reads it. One of the issues, and the stuff we talk about Slop Kings, is this hyper-genrification and training readers to seek out kind of along these nodes of genre. So Lit RPG is literature, RPG literature. So you literally have these, it's often in a serialized format. People release like daily chapters or weekly chapters, and it's about a person being stuck in an RPG or living in an RPG where they literally have video game stats and there's stat blocks in the text of it broken out. And this may sound like a strange, weird thing to you, like why do people read this? If you go on Amazon right now and look up Lit RPG, you'll see people making very handsome livings, like not one person but like several dozen people just generating this stuff in mass. And so that's sort of a view of what sort of popular fiction is looking like now. And I don't want to, I think it's interesting also, like Gabe, you're talking about like this return to like an elite readership, which again, I think everyone should be able to read and enjoy what they want to read, but there is an idea of going through history. I think it's definitely not the norm that every man on the street is reading like highbrow literature. It really was always a sort of high culture thing. And then the lower culture thing was either epics, epic poems, which are spoken to you and, people would listen to you, have sort of a trained sort of seer or whatever that would come to your village and tell those to you, or just those legends, these verbal legends, a lot of very more action-y, or games. So, I wrote the thing about video games, modern video games all sort of build on this classic gaming or sportsmanship thing that was much more the dominant form of entertainment. So I think in some ways, I think that is normal, but I think people that write, I guess, more interesting stuff have to contend. And I think it's an unanswered question now, I guess, to the heart of what you're saying was, you're saying, what do people do? Do you just self-publish and throw it out there, or do you try to go through the system? I think there is, like I said earlier, there's no messy middle to try and separate the wheat from the chaff. And so there's a lot of chaff, this Lit RPG stuff that gets a massive readership just based on genre tagging or that horrible milking farm book, things like that, which is all, it's social media optimized. It's a network it's network platform optimized as opposed to something with an institutional touch. So I think I just always go back to, I think we're trying to frame ourselves in your Plato Caves analogy, Gabe. You know, we're trying to be one of those institutions that provides that kind of like grounding for people that maybe have like a higher thought and opinion and like a deeper level of thought they want to apply to these things. But I don't think it's an answered question at all of like what it's going to look like in a few years in terms of readership, because it seems like the mass sloppulist reader is getting more and more hyper trained into like a guinea pig that just keeps pushing that button, or the rat that he's pushing the button till the pellet comes out for lit RPG stuff, which even that is honestly a miracle. There's as much readership of that. A lot of it's just going to audiobooks.
Right. And I think the best, another example of that is what we were saying earlier, is that the establishment, like, is intrinsically, if you get an official publisher, there's a sense of seriousness, like, you know, adult TM, you know, I'm a serious writer. I'm with the New York Times. I published an essay in The Atlantic. This sense of fake plastic prestige that you put on a pedestal and your opinions are taken as very seriously. We saw this recently with Orrin McIntyre, right? Some leftist on Twitter reviewed his book. He's like, oh, you only have 5 citations in your bibliography. Right? It's,
you know, actually.
You didn't reach the 10 citation limit to be treated as a real philosopher. You know, I mean, how many citations did Plato have in Republic? You know, I don't think he had a very extensive bibliography in the Republic. But lying into our strengths, because in particular, I recommend anyone who's trying to do right-wing literature, authentic right-wing or Chai literature, or authentic us literature of being and body literature. There's a wonderful essay by Wyndham Lewis by When John Bull Laughs. And of course, you would know John Bull is the British version of the Uncle Sam character, you know, the glorious Englishman of the empire with the top hat and the big belly, John Bull. And he has this wonderful essay that in many ways, a puff of laughter is far more dangerous than a puff of smoke. He was writing this right before World War II, and how people have grown grim about the mouth, basically, and how humor is viewed as a baring of teeth, and humor is far more dangerous than serious fiction. I think humor is our biggest weapon. And use Dave's example of Samuel Chamberlain. Samuel Chamberlain is a heritage American. If you're a heritage American, if you have family, if you have bloodline going all the way to the Mayflower, like that's your Homeric epic. Samuel Chamberlain's story of the Mexican American War is very much Homeric, but it's filled with humor and him getting drunk and dueling Mexicans, having sex with Mexican maidens, and having fist fights, blind drunk, and his horse is drunk, and it's very funny. And like, you know, we read this book and appreciate for, you know, yes, you as an American man must read this for your heritage, but and I'll throw in a novel hypothesis that, you know, taller women tend to have wider vaginas, so the reason why short women are more short women than tall women or taller women is because men selected over time shorter women because their vaginas much more smaller than the taller women. And of course, that gets a big laugh and a chuckle and stuff like this, but that it is a chuckle of familiarity, of sameness. We are men. This is a manner bond of literature. So we would evoke this humor, this outrageous hypothesis that I exposed in that particular episode. But the humor is a signal, in many ways, it is a signal that you are us. You are our tribe. You speak our language. You're not a barbarian in the Greek sense. And I think humor, in many ways, is our strongest weapon. It is our strongest idea. Yeah. When the world is absurd, just pointing, you know, you don't have to do much as a comedian. You can just point to the world around you. I mean, Piers Morgan saying, you know, I think the curry is worth it. I think the curry is worth the mass migration. I mean, that sounds like a meme from like 10 years ago. That, like the whole, you know, but the food is so good. It sounds like a parody. Yes. It sounds cliche. To see Piers Morgan actually say it unironically, that's funnier than when we were saying it. I mean, you can literally point at the screen. So I would say overall, you know, literature is serious, but there's all the reason more to treat your humor just as seriously, I'd say. And so again, not being stiff, but not trying to be rigid. I think leaning into our best element, which is humor, is meme culture, you know, meme magic, as we used to say back in the day. I would say inculcating that wild Dionysian energy at the meme magic and harnessing it into an Apollonian arrow into the future. Like, you know, the best writers, you know, Jonathan Ballin talks about this. The great men of our history, he was talking about British culture. I think he was talking about Thomas Carlyle in that particular speech. It's, of course, Thomas Carlyle and the Punch and Judy puppet show, which is very, you know, Charles Dickens used to love the Punch and Judy puppet shows. Used to be very, very popular in London back in the day. I'm pretty sure Punch and Judy are still performed. I don't know, but apparently still performed in little pockets around the UK even today. And, you know, the high intellectualizes the low. You got to meet in the middle. The healthy culture has the intellectual serious art, but the intellectual serious art is rooted in the base humors, in both sense of the term, humors into the rootedness of the earth. So even when you say something overly sexual or something base and crass, is that particular same tree, is that same garden, it's the same veins of the culture you're trying to produce, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think I do follow. Yeah, David, do you want to chime in on this relationship between the high and the low?
Now, actually, I want to put you on the spot, Woz, if I may. Feel free to say no, but are we ever going to see the book? What was the plan? Because you had mentioned doing some fiction writing, I think, earlier on in the year, and I don't know if anything ever came of that.
Oh, well, that was because I had to get back to my normal work. Yeah, that was, I think, 2023. Or maybe 22, actually, when I did that. I set up a Substack for it, Millennial Prose, but I haven't posted any of it yet. It's just time. There's just not enough time, not enough hours in the day. I think that it's something that it's difficult to dip into while doing other things, because it requires fiction writing, any type of writing, requires that you be in a certain mindset. And it takes time. I at least can't just switch between essay writing and fiction writing. It's a completely different discipline. Not much has come of those yet, I'm afraid. It's a shame, because I was really enjoying it. But the real world sort of came knocking at my door. I couldn't keep doing that. So it's quite annoying.
I completely understand, and I intensely relate. I had a personal life event about a year ago that occurred, and I was prolific in my writing for like 2 years or so before that, and then after that, it's just like you said, it's very hard to get into the groove. Yeah, having a stray 10 minutes to write in fiction, in particular, is just not the same as even with nonfiction. But even so, you kind of build up speed as you go, right? Like you're getting some momentum as you're moving. I totally get it. Just curious if there was that anyone questioned that loose thread. But I guess in terms of the high and low, I don't know. I would agree with you, Gabe, that there sort of is that dichotomy, and I think you captured it. I got nothing else to add.
Yeah, I mean, our humor is basically it's intellectual gang sign in many ways. It is FUBU, basically. It is a sign of, like, you know, you are welcome here. And we can speak naturally amongst ourselves.
And to people that aren't exactly us. I guess that's something else we haven't touched on. But I'm very interested in not building walls or building bridges with people that are kind of get it. And I think more and more people are kind of getting it, even if they're not going to identify with all the intricacies of people that have been cooking in this stew for 10 plus years, or you know, like you, Gabe, were sort of inculcated via Gamergate into, and groomed, some might say, into the culture. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people coming from, this is a call I made like a year and a half ago or so now, from the parapolitics sphere. I think there's going to be a lot of people coming from that kind of world and drifting into this one. And I do think there's going to be as Dave Green once prophesized, the blue eyes, red hearts, synthesis. I think it is probably happening. It's probably already happening at some high levels. I don't know. I think something new will form. I don't think it's just going to be the same old meme culture. That's my hope, at least.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to push back a little bit on Woz on the idea of essay writing being different from fiction per se. Because a great example is actually a video essay is by Morgoth. One of Morgoth's best video essays, I think, was on Dune. And it's a great, great study of Dune. right? It's a wonderful analysis. On, I think Morgoth in particular, I mean, he has this very rooted analysis, a way of doing his essay writing. It's not didactic. It's not finger wagging. It comes off extremely natural, his particular essays. It comes off extremely natural. I love when he does movie reviews. Or he did the recent one with the 12 Years Later thing, the zombie movie, which was really great. It was excellent. It's a wonderful piece of essay writing. And I think essays in general, I mean, I'm a David Foster Wallace fan. So, you know, I think essays in themselves can be very treated correctly. But you're not trying to do something didactic. Essays, you're trying to say it would make a point across, but literature is an experience. You have the paper in your hands. In many ways, people forget or don't realize that literature, language is a game, right? It's actually fundamentally interactive. So I think even if you treat essays as a form of, I guess you could say, game construction of as a fundamentally interactive medium rather than a passive medium, I think in many ways, essays in themselves can be in their own way an artistic enjoyment as well, rather than being didactic.
They absolutely are. It's just very different. Like I was saying, it's like a legal suit, right? Like you're trying to put forward like an argument and justification in a way that's entertaining as well. Whereas fiction is just like a different, very different pace and like much more mental vision heavy. I guess it depends on the person. I'm kind of speaking for myself, but. And also, speaking of Morgoth, shout out. Supposedly he has some Lord of the Rings tier fiction I'm pretty sure he's worked on. I don't know if he'll ever release it. Hopefully he does. Because I bet it'll be pretty good.
Yeah, and I happen to know that he is working on something. But I don't know if there's any time frame for its arrival. But he is pursuing that. Yeah, it's just something that I find it a completely different mentality that I had to get into, because you're thinking about characters, motivations, story, like a plot line. You've got to make it make sense, etc. It's very different from essay writing, which is largely arguments and logic and citing facts to back them up, and so forth. So I find it completely different. And it just takes a lot of mental energy to build a fictional world or a situation. So that in turn takes time. So, yeah, I wish I could do both things at once, but I just can't.
Also, it's appetite, right? Like, audience appetite is never very good for fiction in terms of, like, you know, I know you try to make a living and make money doing this stuff. And so exactly. That's a really serious consideration for you. Whereas for someone like me, I could just piss away a Substack post on fiction, and it's, you know, or a lot of people, but if you're like trying to be more serious and conscientious in how you're, because you're a more established figure, right? So you have to be careful with your time. I understand.
Well, I mean, the essay writing takes up all of my time between
300,000 words, right?
January
and that is incredible. So. Yeah. I have never seen that much. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about the podcast? Because this is a sort of calling card for that.
Gabe, do you have any words of wisdom?
For the words of wisdom, you know, it's... Well, I mean, our podcast, again, it's mostly in many ways a friend simulator. You come here if you're a literary chud, if you like reading books and you like the idea, actually, rather than talking about the upteenth Rene Ganon thread on Lit, you know, rather actually talking about something that's actually being produced by people like us, I would highly recommend our channel, because we actually authentically try to grok it, understand the books we read, and I try to actually, this is good, this is quality, this should be experienced by all of us. This is I say it in a somewhat pretentious way, but it is an academy, but not in the, you know, longhouse, you know, sitting in a chair all day, but embodied with people of your tribe, of your cast, of men of gold. You know, anything done nobly can be done crassly. You know, again, I would highly recommend another great person who in many ways spoke in essays, who did essays, but in a vocal form, in a more shamanistic way, I'd say, is actually Jonathan Bowden. I mean, all his speeches are literary essays. He's a very literary figure. I mean, you could see his speeches on Punch and Judy or Judge Dredd comic books. His face lights up. I mean, in many ways, he saw himself and his ideology more in fiction, dare I say, than, let's say, the literary classics. He lived his art. Art was a living, breathing thing told orally and vocally. You know, he took a more shamanistic approach. And I'd say overall for the pod, we take also a shamanistic approach thing. We're not trying to be coming down to the mountain preaching, you must read this, you know, the West has fallen. If you come to our channel, you already know all this. So you come as an equal amongst us, and we try to plant gardens. You know, this particular shrubbery, this beautiful shrub, this book, you know, Jack Norman's Sleep Capricorn, excellent, beautiful. You want some strawberries,
gems,
fed book, and so forth. So I'd say overall, and I'm curious, Melania Wills, we should do this with our guests. Well, what books would you recommend? We'd say either not say the last 10 years, books of your life that you think are good, not only for the chutty quality, but also
fiction or nonfiction, though.
Either or, I'm curious.
Oh, I like, I'm the wrong person to ask. I don't read books. I don't have time.
That's what the podcast is for. You can pretend to read. You can pretend.
Yeah, you can pretend if we get a good summary.
No, look, I'm not the person to ask that. I wish I were. I wish I could give you a better answer, but no, I can't, I'm afraid. But I do think that what you're saying is true, that there are things that are understood and we don't need to keep mulling them over endlessly, because a lot of us have been in this for a long time and we know all that. And I think it's important now to envision a future and to build towards that culturally, to lay the groundwork for that. And I think that the mainstream just is completely out of ideas in that regard, has absolutely no idea where to go from here, from 2025. So I definitely agree with you on that. David, is there anything else you'd like to say about the podcast?
No, I like what you both just said about people coming as equals, because that was definitely a hope of mine, is that I think you can go stir crazy in these circles. Again, with, you know, the things often get promoted is, I always go back to the image of, you know, some immigrant coming and punching some woman and people just playing that on loop, like a TikTok of that on to get reaction and that hyperstimulation. And so I do hope we kind of have, we bring a, maybe like a slower form of entertainment, and then hopefully give people some interesting thoughts in a fun way, and with topics and with books that they haven't heard of, right? I don't think anyone's covered most of the things we've covered on the book side in particular, but even with the other things we do, I think we bring a unique perspective kind of this scene. But there's been a lot of people that will comment or share with us that they're really not from that world, right? They just stumbled across it randomly because they like Brandon Sanderson as an example. So we do something about Brandon Sanderson and a thing, and then it brings some people there. And I'm not trying to recruit people. I'm trying to find like-minded people or people that are tuned into kind of the, like, what's wrong with the world? Because I think there's a lot of people, I think there are a lot of people that are coming around and like understanding the underlying issues people like you were identifying very clearly a decade ago, and other people were identifying 40 years ago. But it's just the material reality is forcing increased attention on these things. And so, and people get that elsewhere. People get an incredible amount of awareness of how horrible things are going elsewhere. And so I don't want to, we're not people that pretend it's all good. We're not an EFAP like chuckle session where everyone just, you know, we pretend it's the 90s still. We all get it. Everyone's on the same page, but also we're not going to dwell on things that are completely out of our control, at least not unduly. And yeah, just try and build a living thing. So yeah, that's my hope. And thank you sincerely for having us on. It was really sort of a lifetime goal of mine to at some point be able to make my appearance in Millennial. So I can check that off. Check that off my list.
We're officially initiated into the old heads.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad that we got around to this. It sounds like you're both very enthusiastic and passionate about what you do and about this, well, the cultural milieu that we're all part of. So I'm glad that you're doing this. All right, well, let's end it there, because we are still quite early in the millennial run, and I'm not quite into the rhythm, so I'm getting quite tired. That's not a count against you at all. It's my own fault, really, for not becoming nocturnal soon enough. Anyway, I think this has been good. I think I hope that people check out your podcast, and I wish you luck with it. Okay, well, tomorrow night I will be back with. Let me just see what's happening tomorrow night. Dangerfield, who's publishing books himself, And then Elizabeth Heverin, and then Norman Eckert, and then the alternative hypothesis, Ryan Falk. So that should be quite interesting. Gabriel, any last words before we finish?
Last word. You know, as a teacher, I would be amiss to not to recommend some starter pack literature, as was recommended to me. I would, if you're interested in the art of both combining both the crude Volkishness of Punch and Judy and the best of Dickens and the best of all High and Low, I'd say particularly Wyndham Lewis's essay collection, Men Without Art, Creatures of Habit and Creatures of Change. And particularly, he actually narrated the John Bull Laughs. It's on YouTube, Wyndham Lewis, When John Bull Laughs. He actually narrated it himself. You can find it on YouTube. Particularly that essay in particular, you know, the using humor as a weapon. You know, Napoleon started off as a laugh, famously the old school Puck cartoons of miniature Napoleon trying to eat the whole world. So that essay in particular, I think, is a great starter pack to what we're trying to inculcate in particular. So I'd recommend if anyone who's actually interested in producing authentic art for ourselves, for this thing of ours, I say particularly starting off with those essays by Wyndham Lewis, I'd say. I will end it with some recommendations.
Excellent. David?
Yeah, please go check our stuff out. Gabe, I had a new revelation for you. The next thing I think we might do, I've been reading the Iliad recently. Morrowind is the modern Iliad, the Iliad of the 21st century. Unironically, this is my belief. Every page I read, I'm like, wow, this is just like Morrowind. This is the same bickering gods, the same everything. Anyway, more on that. But like you said, we have a lot of fun. I think that's why we're so excited about it, because we have a lot of fun together as sort of a group. And the people I've met, like the writers and other guys in it, just incredibly quality people, like to a man. Like, I have not met one bad egg in the bunch. Like, it really draws the right kind of people that have sort of the weird passion to get into these artistic expressions. Someone that really has dedication and interest. So. I would encourage people to check them out as well. The authors, you know, Nutcracker, Dan Baltic. That's start with the Greeks. That's where you can start. Start with Nutcracker.
Cranker, Sleep Capricorn, Sleep Capricorn Fed Book, and of course, Mixtape Hyperborea. I think those four.
You can't go wrong. Yeah, they're all outstanding.
All right, good recommendations. Okay, then. Well, thank you very much, Gabriel and David from Tookie's Mag, for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you very much.
All right. Everyone else, I will see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.